Welcome to the Humanities Professionals Podcast, conversations hosted by Micah Olsey, a historian of philosophy, culture, music, and the arts. Micah sits down with thought leaders and creatives from across the country, asking what value the study of the humanities brings to their lives and what edge it brings to their work. Beyond that, the conversations include advice to artists and young scholars trying to earn a living or navigate the job market. Enjoy the show.
All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome again to the Humanities Professional Podcast. I'm Micah Olsey, and ready and excited to have another guest on the show. Today we have Alex McKay, who is an intellectual properties lawyer in Nashville, Tennessee. What does that mean, that she's an intellectual properties lawyer? Well, good question. It means she works with copyright, with trademarks, and with intellectual property rights, among other issues. She graduated from the prestigious law school, the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and has been quite active in the community and quite successful in her professional work. She has been named among Nashville's best lawyers on a regular basis over the past decade. And Alex is featured on our podcast today both because of her humanities background and because of her ongoing humanities work today. She will tell us more about this in just a second. But before going to law school, she studied, as I understand we'll find out, music at Vanderbilt University, I think. In addition, she continues to support music and the arts in Nashville and has sat on the board of the Nashville Philharmonic Orchestra, a volunteer community orchestra of amateur and professional musicians that brings symphony music free of charge to audiences around Middle Tennessee. Awesome. She has also sat on other community boards, including the Tennessee Justice Center and the local nonprofit organization 10,000 Villages, which supports fair trade and artisans in Nashville and across the world. So, with that, Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm wondering if we can just start out to get a little more context. I obviously shared a couple of points here, but if you could give us a little more context about yourself just by telling us your life story.
Well, thank you very much for having me as a guest on this podcast. I'm excited to be here. I grew up in Nashville, where we are today, and I grew up studying music, studying obviously in school, and really loved music and wanted to pursue that in college and had the good fortune to be able to do that. I also was a double major in Spanish in college and loved getting to do both. And I went through a sort of crisis, a mini crisis towards the end of college, where I had been waiting for this lightning bolt to strike and for the heavens to open and the light to shine down and for somebody to be like, this will be your career.
This is your perfect path.
It will be, yes. You know, I just sort of expected that to happen.
Did it come?
It didn't come. Okay. I had a lot of anxiety about what to do. There were lots of things I loved to think about, to love to study, but wasn't sure what would make a reasonable career path. And I ended up taking a battery of interest tests, which you could do through the counseling center at Vanderbilt. And one of those tests told me I should go into one of three careers. I should be either a florist, which was interesting because I could not have named you 10 flowers if you'd asked me on a dare, or a member of the clergy, which I thought was pretty impressive considering, you know, this test doesn't know anything about me, or a lawyer. So that one seemed like the most reasonable of the three options. So I ended up taking the LSAT and exploring law school. And some of the skills that I had developed in undergrad seemed to push me in that direction as well. So I did that a little bit thinking, I'm going to still think about music. I'm just going to do this and put my toe in and see what it's like, but I don't want to leave music yet. And the thing about law school is that you put your toe in and it sucks the whole of you inside. So that's kind of what happened to me. And I've never left music. That's always been a super important part of my life. And I try to keep, you know, some engagement with Spanish and other studies as well. But yes, then I pursued a career in law, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Okay, great. Well, I have so many questions. I want to learn a little bit more about the profession, the trajectory you've taken with law. But before, I want to ask more about the music. Mm-hmm. Tell me, do you play on a regular basis? Either do you practice on a daily basis? Do you play around town? And did you do that during law school as well? Or what's going on with that?
Yes. Yeah, so let me just credit all of the teachers that I've had in violin throughout my childhood and through college and thereafter, and even now, because they have all inspired a love of the music. And that I feel very lucky to have. I've never stopped loving music. And some people who get very good at it do stop loving it.
Right.
Like that can, there can be a attention there. But I've always had the gift of loving it, even if I haven't had the gift of doing it as well as I would like. So part of how I chose, I applied to two different law schools. One was Vanderbilt because I had spent, you know, all this time studying at Blair and loved Blair, the School of Music. And I thought, you know, why leave a place I love? And one was Michigan. And one of the reasons Michigan was appealing to me is because they have this phenomenal music program.
That's so true.
And so I, in law school, I played with the Gilbert and Sullivan shows. I played in the non-majors orchestra. I played in the Pops orchestra. I substitute taught for a friend a couple times. Like, it was a little ridiculous. My grades might have shown that the first couple semesters of law school. But I was not prepared to leave that. Like, right. that's it wasn't me goofing off. It was me. I did not see that as goofing off. I saw it as feeding a necessary part of my soul.
And I imagine it kept you going through law school as well, because that's a tough
experience. Law school was hard. Yeah, law school was really challenging. And part of what was challenging was that as much music as it sounds like I was doing, I wasn't doing nearly as much as I had been in undergrad. Like, as a music major, that is your whole, like, you're taking 11 classes and probably 9 or 10 of them center around either playing music or studying music. And it was a radical diminishment of just the amount of my time that I could play. And that was a psychological blow that I hadn't expected. Mm-hmm. But definitely I hung on to music and needed
it. What is the psychological advantage of playing on a daily basis for you in the midst of a tense or stressful and busy law career?
Well, I'm not like Sherlock Holmes. Like, I'm not like in my office figuring out problems while noodling on the violin. That would probably annoy my colleagues. But there is something really special about playing an instrument that I think it's hard to find in any other career. It connects your mind and your body and your soul in a really unique way. Like, there is something happening between my fingers and my arm and my brain that doesn't happen when you're just clicking on a keyboard, right? Like, it doesn't connect you as a whole human being the same way. Practicing law is very engaging, and there are parts of it that I love, but it can feel very much like you're in this virtual space a lot of the time. Like, it's very in your head.
Inside your head.
Yeah. And so the physicality of music and how that connects with the heart, too, is part of what I need to just stay involved with.
To stay healthy, mm-hmm. stay on top of the game. What does a day in the life look like at this firm doing intellectual properties?
Every day can be different. The one thing that is the same is that I will begin every day by writing on my sheet of paper, these are the 5 things I must get done today. And then I spend the rest of the day responding to demands and needs of other people.
Okay.
Like, it's almost humorous where I'm like, nope. I wrote them down and then I got the first phone call. Yeah. Somebody needed this, some urgent, you know. But as a practical matter, I mean, I could be working on, my practice tends to be, there's some litigation, but my practice tends to be much more often trademark prosecution, which basically means filing trademark applications.
Okay.
I might resolve disputes informally, like through settlement discussions. That happens quite a lot, helping clients enforce their trademarks in the marketplace and helping clients commercially exploit their trademarks through license agreements. And then I do a fair number of technology license agreements, software license agreements, or helping people who are conducting due diligence or engaging in other kinds of commercial transactions that involve intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So it's a variety. You might guess that a lot of my work is in the music field because mm-hmm. of my background, but that didn't actually happen.
Okay, perfect.
So I do some occasionally in the music world, but I spend much more of my time in connection with trademarks. And trademarks are any sort of word, tagline, image. It can be colors or sounds, anything that serves as an indication of source, so that when you see it, you recognize that it comes from the same source as the last time you saw it. So The Coke bottle, the shape of the Coke bottle, is an example of trade dress.
Okay.
The word Coke is an example of a trademark. And so, yes, there are definitely performers who register their names or their stage names as trademarks so that people recognize them as the source of the goods and services that they provide. So somebody in that capacity might come to me. I might help them register their name, show them how to use their mark in a trademark fashion so that it'll be accepted by the PTO, help them enforce those rights against people who are infringing, like trying to capitalize on their goodwill. And
so Pepsi tries to use the Coke bottle shape, mm-hmm. and Pepsi could be sued for that.
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. great. Or they mm-hmm. might say, enjoy Pepsi instead of enjoy Coca-Cola, because that's also, is like,
oh, yeah, enjoy Coke is a trademark.
Okay.
Yeah. Hopefully Pepsi wouldn't be doing that.
Just trying to think of like simple examples so I can understand what's going
yes.
on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. What's mm-hmm. What's the best part, the most rewarding part of your job or mm-hmm. or something that you said, wow, this really worked out well. It's made me mm-hmm. excited to be in this career, something mm-hmm. like that. Kind of a more positive experience.
There are a couple things there are lots of things that are wonderful about my job. One of the best things is that when people come to a lawyer, so often in if you look at all the different types of legal practice that there are, so often people come to lawyers at a really difficult time in their life and they have big problems. And that sometimes happens to me too, and I'm grateful to have the tools to help people solve their problems. But one of the most rewarding things is that sometimes people come to me not because they have a negative experience, but because they're about to launch a new product line, or they're starting a new company, or they've got this new idea and they need some help protecting it. And so I get to learn about new ideas on the ground floor, right? And it's really kind of exciting because, you know, as you know, with anybody who has any sort of creative endeavor, that's their baby, right? And so you're kind of there helping them birth their baby. You're getting to see it as it grows. And so that's a super rewarding experience, is to just be there with that excitement and to be helpful in getting their project off the ground. That's really exciting. And then another thing is just you learn every day. Like being in the intellectual property world, your practice, your legal practice is so affected by changes in technology, advances in technology.
Okay.
Every time there's a new way of communicating or a new way of doing things, there's a new way to infringe or there's a new way to commercially exploit your property. And so we're constantly having to learn and get up to speed. And I really love that. That is something that is very much like what college felt like, which is,
okay.
you know, I'm constantly learning something new. I'm constantly engaging my brain and trying to map on these principles to this new terrain.
Right. There's so much innovation here,
mm-hmm.
and you get to see the innovation before it actually comes out onto
mm-hmm.
the stage. You get to see innovation
yes.
backstage before the actual performance.
Yes, yes. That's a great way of putting it.
Do you help also, like, do you use your own creativity? You had mentioned kind of helping protect new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Is this also a chance for you to be creative in how you protect that idea?
You do have to be. I mean, sometimes things are very straightforward and sometimes you have to kind of work around obstacles that are in your path. Like sometimes the thing that somebody wants to do is not available to them. So you either just have to tell them to redirect or you have to help be strategic in how they approach the issue so they can circumvent this issue. Or you have to be strategic if you're just negotiating with somebody to resolve a problem. You know, that there are some, you know, pretty standard ways of like, okay, I'm going to sue you, or okay, I'll pay you this much money, or, you
right.
know, but sometimes you can think of win-win opportunities
okay.
that might not be obvious or that are unique to the particular industry or set of circumstances. And so it does exercise your brain, like to try to figure out, how am I going to persuade this person on the other side of the table to do what my client wants or to enable my client to do what they want?
One of the things we haven't brought up is that you also speak Spanish, and that mm-hmm. you brought that up, that you majored in that at
mm-hmm.
Vanderbilt. I'm thinking that maybe that there's a connection between your experience being bilingual and having that
mm-hmm.
that cultural translation experience in undergrad,
mm-hmm.
and then being able to be an effective translator
mm-hmm.
between two different worlds, a business world and a legal world.
I'd love to think that. I would love to think that. No, I think language is fascinating. And I think, as I told you earlier, that you know, I wish I could spend more time speaking Spanish and practicing Spanish and immersing myself in the literature, Spanish literature. I don't
right.
get to do it nearly often enough. But there's one simple example in terms of cultural exchange. So a lot of times I'm communicating with marketing The marketing person in the business. Sometimes it's the in-house counsel for the client. Sometimes it's a marketing person. Sometimes it's the owner of the business if it's a small enough business. And I have learned that apparently law school and business school basically teach radically different ways of thinking.
Okay.
That's my perception based on my experience. And so I do feel sometimes like when the marketing person and I both are trying to bridge a little bit of a cultural gap, especially when you're talking about trademarks, because trademarks, so there's this sort of spectrum of strength for trademarks, and trademarks are stronger. They're inherently strong if they don't immediately convey information about the ingredient or quality of the good or service that you're selling. So, for example, if you sold apples and you wanted to use the trademark apple, you couldn't. You couldn't claim a trademark in the word apple because it's generic and it's telling you exactly what you're selling. So you can't claim that. But if you want to use the term apple to sell computers, that's a totally arbitrary term. And so it's an inherently strong mark because it has absolutely nothing to do with the good you're selling, right?
Wow.
So as trademark lawyers, we're constantly trying to get business people, I shouldn't say it quite that way, but as trademark lawyers, that's a counterintuitive thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'll just acknowledge that's a counterintuitive
absolutely.
Thing. It's become ingrained in me because I spend all my day doing this sort of thing, but it is counterintuitive for most people. And I think in business, quite often people are like, we want the consumer to know immediately what we're selling.
Right.
So we try to use terms as trademarks that will immediately convey. So there's, anyway, that's one example of like trying to bridge the cultural gap. Like, well, I understand
amazing.
Why they want to do that. The law, unfortunately, is written in a counterintuitive way. We have to figure out how to accomplish their goals, but still pick them a strong mark, because in the end, that's more valuable.
You did mention before the podcast that you were involved in, and I already forgot the name of it, but an international trademark
association. That's the name of the
okay. Yoga. Perfect. ITA. Amazing.
Oh, INTA. Yes.
Okay. So and that has allowed you at different times to host bilingual panels or mm-hmm. to talk to people cross culturally.
Mm-hmm.
What have you done there, and what has that given back to you in terms of networks or professional possibilities, or just giving back to a broader community?
INTA is one of the most professionally rewarding experiences I've gotten to have over the years. So it's an international organization of trademark owners.
Okay.
And each year it's got an annual meeting in May that has about 10,000 people attend, and then a leadership meeting in November, which is much smaller. And yes, during the year you can host roundtables. We hosted one a couple weeks ago. At the annual conferences, you can hold table topics on subjects, and that's where I got to do the bilingual table topic. And and I do a fair amount of committee work where we're talking about different issues and how, in particular, trademarks are being treated in different jurisdictions. And a lot of the work that INTA does is to try to increase harmonization, because so often we have brand owners who are operating on a global level, right? So they want some consistency and predictability and how, you know, what their expectations can be across countries, across jurisdictional lines. So it's just fascinating because you will meet somebody who thinks, well, I think this is clearly the way it should be handled. And, you know, you'll meet somebody from another country that says, well, that's not how we do that here. And they're getting sort of more enforced, more and more nuanced and niche issues over time. But it's super interesting. And so I love meeting people from different countries. I love getting to practice my Spanish. We have started a Latina lawyers, very informal group. Like, we've had two meetings now where we get together and just sit and talk, and they're nice to let me in.
That's amazing.
They allow me to sit with them.
So tell me about your experience in the Nashville Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. What is that? How have you participated? And has that also been a more personal, rewarding experience, or has that also somehow snowballed into work with your career?
So the Nashville Philharmonic Orchestra is a nonprofit organization. It was started in 2003 or 4 by Kelly Corcoran, who was at the time the assistant conductor of the Nashville Symphony. And the mission of the organization is twofold. One is to give area musicians an opportunity to perform, and also it is to take music to different communities throughout the region. And I got involved maybe 8 years ago, and it's led by Chris Norton from Belmont, who you may be familiar with. He's a phenomenal conductor. He's amazing. Because we are comprised, the orchestra is comprised of members of the community. And so you have some people who are recent graduates of either college mm-hmm. or graduate school studies in music. You have some people who've retired from careers in music. You have some people who play professionally a totally different genre of music. Like, we have some professional fiddlers who are like, I want to play orchestral music for fun. And the vast majority, though, are people like me who do something else during the day and do this for fun or to feed their soul in the evening. And we range from people who've been studying from since childhood to people who are adult learners. And so Chris takes this group and we work together on projects. We're like about 85, 90 piece orchestra. Wow. So it's a big group.
Wow.
We play a lot of late 19th century and, 20th century music because of our size. And he like our most recent concert series, we played Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony. I mean, that's kind of an amazing thing.
Yes.
To take a bunch of community musicians and do that with. It was it's an incredibly rewarding experience. So I've played in the orchestra again for like 8 years, and then the past couple years I've been serving on the board as well. And so that always gives you a different insight into the organization. Like you get some sort of a background view of like how this all works. Like, it takes a lot of effort to give these opportunities to all of these people. And I do that because I feel so rewarded by getting to play in the orchestra. Like, that's one way I hope that I can use my skill set to help the organization do the same for others.
And they do free concerts for the community.
It's
is
all
that right?
free. Yes.
Okay.
No charge.
Let me ask this really hard, impossible question is always on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to measure the outcomes of mm-hmm. of these kind of musical projects in the community? Because mm-hmm. I know that music improves the quality of life for its listeners. Mm-hmm. It changes the lives of those that are involved in so mm-hmm. many ways. But it's so hard to measure the outcomes of a mm-hmm. concert. Have you guys, as a board, is there a way that you talk about that or measure that or try and look for its impact in the community?
Well, we have some metrics that we keep track of. I don't think any of us would say that any single one of them accurately or fully captures the impact that
right.
we have. But, we try to count audience members.
Okay.
Like, we try to, talk about the numbers of time we play at particular venues. For example, one of the venues that we have played at the past 5 years or so is Iglesia Hispana.
Mm.
It's primarily Spanish-speaking congregation. And the audience size, I think, has increased over time when we go. And the connection that the orchestra feels with the audience is huge. I mean, I almost cry at that concert every year. Even if the repertoire isn't always... Sometimes it's phenomenal, but sometimes it's not the reason you play an orchestra,
right?
Right? Like, it's Christmas music sometimes, right? But the audience connection is unlike any other. The enthusiasm that you feel and the welcome that we feel as an orchestra is amazing. So that you can't quantify,
right?
We can say we've been there this many times.
Right.
We can say this many people attended the audience. We can say, and to get to the sort of like reaching across, Chris is really great about programming pieces. Like, we just played Danzón number 2 at the last time we played.
Oh, okay, fantastic.
And often he will pull out a marimba piece because there are so many people from Guatemala, and that's a folk instrument of Guatemala.
Right.
And so that we know that's going to be a hit. Like, but clearly, like, we are making an effort to learn repertoire within the orchestral
It's culturally
realm.
Relevant.
Yes, right? So we are learning... Right. And hopefully also reaching out and offering something that they might be particularly interested in. And then maybe they hear something else, too, that they are interested in. It is amazing. And I'll say a couple other things about that. Like, we have the two concert masters, we have one in the fall and one in the spring. And they are both Nashville Symphony violinists, Jessica and Denise. And they are incredibly generous with their time to, they definitely help lead and help us learn and excel more and more. And I think, like, I keep hearing from them how much they enjoy playing it. There is something about playing in the NPO. There is something about doing it for its own sake that you just can't replicate, right? I mean, all of us want to have jobs where we get to do what we love to do, but there is also something about just doing it because you love it without regard to making a living or anything else that can't be replicated. So we're very fortunate. I feel very lucky to be part of that organization. It's given a lot.
If you were talking to an undergraduate, or I know there's undergraduates that are listening right now, that either have a, that are majoring in music performance, or that are majoring in Spanish, or that are majoring even in the visual arts, and they're some of them are thinking, I want to go to law school. And others of them are saying, I really have no clue what to do with my music degree, and I don't know if I should actually pursue it as a performer or maintain this as something that I do on the side as a way to stay involved with the community. What would you, what are some pieces of advice, both maybe like philosophical, deep, and then also just very practical? Someone wants to be a lawyer, someone wants to be an intellectual properties lawyer. What's some philosophical and then some practical advice?
Okay, if somebody wants to be a lawyer, I would say my career path is not the one to take. And here's what not to take about it. Like I, as I said earlier, had a moment of like, how come the heavens didn't part and tell me what career I should have? What am I going to do? Law school is great in the sense that you don't have to be an expert in any subject to go to law school. You know, the LSAT, what it tests you on is reading comprehension and then these logic games that you can learn for the test, right? Like, but you, unlike going to business school or to med school or to graduate school in any particular subject, you don't have to know a particular subject.
Okay.
In that sense, it's phenomenal. And I think there's something really wonderful about that because that enables it to attract, you know, future lawyers of really diverse backgrounds, right? Like you can come from any area of study, any spectrum. But the risk with that is that you get, it attracts people like me who are in moments of indecision, right? Like, and that can be a way of deferring the decision in a way as going to law school. And especially in the past 10 years, that's become a very dangerous thing to do, just because for a while we were graduating twice as many law students as there were jobs.
Right.
So I would not recommend that people go to law school for that, the same reason I went to law school. I mean, it turns out that I was lucky. I went to school at a different time, and it turns out I like practicing law, but I think that's a really dangerous approach. So I would say don't do that. If you want to go to law school, I would recommend that people do take some logic classes. Most importantly, take economic classes.
Okay.
Those are important. I hadn't taken those.
Okay.
Wished that I had by the time I got to law school. And what they really should do, and nobody likes to hear this, but what they should really do is before they go to law school, after they graduate college, they should do something else for at least 2 to 5 years. And the reason for that is that law school, you get the most out of law school if you know why you're getting your law degree. Like, I'm getting my law degree to make this change in the world, right?
Okay.
This is why. You get much more out of it, and you have more life experience. Like, you think about the classes that you take in law school. I took this commercial transactions class, and they're talking about security agreements and bank loans. And I was like, well, I have a checking account. Like, right? Like, I didn't have a family. I hadn't, you know, like I hadn't engaged in these kinds of transactions in the world. So how am I supposed to?
There's no connection there.
Right. I don't have the facts to hang these theories on. So both for that reason, like just to sort of gain some experience so that you're like, I remember what it was like when I applied for a loan. Like when you're sitting in that class, you get much more out of the meaning of it. So I have thought, like, if the ABA came to me and was like, what changes should we make to accrediting law schools, which they, of course, have not done. I would say that
if you're there,
should be,
ABA, if you're listening to this podcast, this is Alex McKay, please.
That's right. Here's my suggestion. I think there should be a rebuttable presumption that you can't go directly from college to law school, that you have to have spent some time in the workforce. And again, some people can go straight through and do great. But again, I think the majority of us would benefit a lot more from having a sense of what it's like to live in the real world and from, you know, figuring out how you want to use your law degree. Like, what is it that you want to do? Why do you want to do that?
It's kind of, it gives you a focus, or what I sometimes call, because I'm always teaching writing, this question of having a life thesis.
Yes.
Right. You have some aim that you're getting to, and then as you take in the information from law school, you can kind of focus it, or you can apply it to your area of interest as well.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So I think that's, and I tell people a lot, law makes a great second career, because again, to get into law school, it teaches, you have to know reading comprehension. any of us, right, can probably sit down and maybe take a few practice tests, but then brush up enough to take that test. Unlike music school, unlike going to get, you know, a graduate degree in history, unlike anything else where those skills, if you don't use them, will fall away. And so you kind of want to get to the program as quickly as you can while it's all fresh in your head. Presumably, and maybe I'm making too much of a presumption there, but many careers require you to keep reading, like, or maybe you'll just keep reading because you love it. And so, again, I think a lot of people who go to law after doing something else
benefit.
Are the happiest. They they know why they're there. They know what they're using their law degree for.
And you could probably mm-hmm. take, while you're working mm-hmm. in that 2 to 5 year period, you could mm-hmm. also spend nights and weekends studying for the LSAT, get a better
just nights, not weekends.
Just nights. Okay. get better score and be able to move somewhere else as well. Who mm-hmm. knows? I want to move straight to this question about the contemporary issue of the field. We've been talking about this right before mm-hmm. our podcast, and you mentioned something that was absolutely fascinating and completely relevant to larger debates and larger movements and changes today. So I was wondering if you mm-hmm. could bring up this question of the trademark cases that mm-hmm. that has come up recently in the U.S.
Yeah. So maybe to sort of zoom out a little bit,
please.
The federal trademark law is called the Lanham Act. The Lanham Act was written in 1946. It has a clause in there, Section 2A, that has two subclauses. And the way the statute is written, people were prohibited from registering trademarks that were disparaging. That was one of the subclauses of groups of people. Mm-hmm. And then the statute also prohibited the registration of immoral or scandalous marks. So last summer, in June of 2017, the Supreme Court heard a case called In Re Tam, in which Tam had challenged the constitutionality of the disparagement clause. And just to give a little factual background of Tam, which, by the way,
is this the airline? Tam?
No, Tam is Simon Tam. It's his last name.
Okay.
Simon Tam started a band, and he named the band The Slants. And so he tried to register the trademark for the band name, and the Patent and Trademark Office refused registration, saying, well, The Slants is a disparaging term for Asian Americans.
Okay.
And so we're not going to let you register that mark. And he first tried to argue against that refusal, but they pointed to, I mean, this band is pretty amazing. Like, they have a very sort of social political statement that they're trying to make. So you listen to their lyrics, you look at their albums. I mean, clearly they are using that term. They are reappropriating the term is what they're doing.
Okay.
They're basically taking a term that I think had become much less used as a disparaging term, but was still recognized mm-hmm. by some as a disparaging term, and reappropriating it to sort of say, like, to basically eliminate it as a disparaging term. So it was a very interesting case. It paralleled another case that dealt with the disparagement clause that was a radically different set of facts, which I'll just put to the side because it will otherwise confuse the issue. And I should say that Simon Tam speaks to groups now. Like mm-hmm. he came and spoke to our bar association. He speaks to different groups. And if any of your listeners ever encounter him, he's really worth hearing because his personal life story informs why he started a band like this. And then his persistence in fighting this battle made huge change in the way law is practiced. So he tells a really great story. When you talk about compelling personal stories, he's really got one. Anyway, so the trademark office refused registration of his mark. Then he appeals it to different levels. He finally gets to the Supreme Court, and ultimately the Supreme Court decided that the disparagement clause that prohibited registration of marks that disparage groups was unconstitutional. So because there was a plurality decisions, which means that there was no single majority decision because one justice didn't participate in the decision. So you had four justices side with one opinion, four with another, right?
Okay.
But the net effect of the combination is all the justices unanimously agreed that that the disparagement clause violated the Constitution. So the Trademark Office can no longer prohibit somebody from registering a mark that's disparaging of groups. So it's kind of interesting, right? Like, when you think, what are the consequences going to be? Certainly there was at least a temporary small rush of filing applications with all kinds of horrible epithets as trademarks or parts of trademarks.
Which had very different intentions than what TAMS originally was. So TAMS trying to reappropriate a denigrating term and maybe eliminate its negative consequences, but then he kind of releases, or the dam breaks and releases all sorts of people that are actually aspiring to register racial caricatures or racial characterizations or other or homophobic or xenophobic kind of terms. Is that's what's going on?
Well, yes. I will say I have not quantified since last June like how many people have filed these applications. I have this hope and belief in humanity that's going to die down, that it was sort of like, temporary rush because the permissions, the prohibition was lifted. I don't think that's going to have long-term – I don't think it's going to be likely that long-term we'll see those kinds of marks flooding the marketplace. Okay. Because people still want to sell their goods and services to everybody.
Right.
And so they probably most often don't want to alienate people. But, the trademark office doesn't have that restriction anymore. And just, for comparison's sake, some people are doing – different people have different reasons for registering the mark. Tam's case is particularly interesting for the reasons you just described, that he's reappropriating this term and using it in connection with a very expressive service, like it's the performing services. The other case that was kind of preceding a parallel path but didn't ever make it to the Supreme Court was the that DC football team.
Yes.
And so that mark too, they had gotten a registration, and then somebody had petition to cancel the registration on the grounds that mark was disparaging.
Right.
In that case, the plaintiff was saying, I feel disparaged by this mark. So from a legal perspective, it was really fascinating to have those two cases running in parallel tracks, because there were so many possibilities for comparing and contrast. Like, you have this adversary proceeding over here, ex parte proceeding over here. You have this person saying, I feel disparaged. You have this person, like, Tam is a member of the allegedly disparaged group, and he's saying, I don't feel like I'm reappropriating it. And, you have this group over here, which has an argument that this kind of speech is expressive, which the Supreme Court declined to decide whether the trademark was an expressive term or whether it was commercial speech or expressive speech. And then over here, I think it's much more challenging to argue that the trademark that they use has an expressive purpose. So you have... There was part of me that really wished that the Supreme Court had been confronted with the facts of both cases at the same time, that might have informed
the context.
Yes, but lucky them, they didn't have to rule on the DC football case. That was my perception.
Well, even with the case of the slants, it's interesting the way that the same words can be reappropriated, the same images can be changed, and our value systems, as they pivot around those images, can certainly evolve as well. Amazing. Alex, that's our time for today. I'm wondering if you have any closing words that you'd like to give to the listeners. And if not, then that's all right as well.
No, well, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you for having me on the podcast. And I guess to anybody who's listening, continue to love the humanities, because whether or not it leads directly to a career, it will lead to lifelong reward and enjoyment.
Wow, thank you so much. This is Alex McKay, intellectual property lawyer in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Michael Olsey, and thank you so much for joining us with the Humanities Professionals Podcast, and we will be back soon.